led the world in so many ways, and we've exported so many good things. Democracy, the rule of law, we ended slavery, we stood up against the Nazis when we had nothing really to fight them with, we had that moral courage. So I think if you make a place like the UK go dark, then a lot of other places will go dark very quickly.
But because there are a few bats and there is an organisation called English Nature, you decide to spend £100 million on a bat tunnel. Ladies and gentlemen, we could have built 3 bats Ritz hotels, given each one of these bats their personal butler, you know.
So my third model is based on looking at the total number of goals scored in any Premier League season, taking the square root of it and dividing it by 25. And it looks like that's probably going to beat the OBR economic forecast as well.
So we will be treated as a defeated people. If you want to walk under the yoke, go ahead. I don't.
So, first of all, tell me, how do you juggle politics with family, personal life and work?
Well, I do have a personal life. A lot of people don't think I don't, but I do have a personal life. And I'm very fortunate. I'm at a stage in my life where I turned 50 last year. I've got 2 grown-up kids, so that's kind of done. You know, I still have a lot to do with them, but they're not dependent on me anymore. I'm self-employed. And so I've got space in my life, I've got flexibility, I can kind of make this a bit of a focus, and it just seems to be a season in my life, and I'm really enjoying it, so, and I hope eventually I achieve my goal.
What tips would you give to somebody who's perhaps thinking of either standing as a councillor, or perhaps looking at some other role in politics, who's perhaps working full-time right now, and they may be tonight here as a supporter, but thinking they'd like to go a step further?
Well, I think if you're not sure about being an elected official, I think a council is a good way to kind of put your toe in the water and see if that's for you, because it's, you know, it's a well-defined, you know, your ward, your area, it's local, about being a community champion, and you won't get the same sort of media profile that MPs get, for example, or mayors or other roles like that, police and crime commissioners. So I think that's a good way to start and just see, you know, and it's also a good way to prepare yourself if you do want to go further and become, go and you'll stand for Parliament. You know, that's a good pathway. I would say, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. I mean, I've been in this about 3 years now, and so I'm not a career politician, and I got into it, and it's kind of got the bug quite early on, and I see people who get involved, and I can see after a few months they've got the bug slowly taking over the life, and in a good way, right? But in some ways, I don't think you can do it in half measures, you know, because you're not really going to get anywhere. You'll have all the things that are against you, you know, the challenges, the opposition, but you won't make any progress. So I think if you're going to do it, you need to be able to commit to it, you know, in a proper way.
Would you also recommend that maybe people start by doing some of the more basic routine tasks that are needed to become a great campaigner?
Yes, I would say if you're still not ready to take the plunge and stand for, is to go and support somebody else, because I think by doing that, by getting involved with campaigning, knocking on doors, helping out with social media events like this, for example, or even on a much smaller scale, you can kind of get that feel and understand how politics works and where your strengths lie as well. So I think that would be a good way in.
So you had quite some experience campaigning and canvassing and obviously standing for a number of seats prior to your position now. What made you decide to stand for a position on the board at Reform UK?
Well, I wasn't planning to stand. You know, I saw it, I knew it was coming because it's in the constitution, and it was the summer and I was quite busy with work, and I saw it come out and I thought, oh, it's finally been advertised. And I saw a lot of people who I knew were going to go for it, and they all rushed at it. And I thought, oh yeah, all the faces I expected, we were going to be keen. And I just let it slip for a couple of days, and someone convinced me that you should apply for this. And he did. And so I was on playing catch up really on the others. But then I managed to get a campaign together, and it just sort of went from there.
So since you've been on the board, Dan, you've had a lot of different experiences, of course, meeting Reform members,
yes,
meeting branch chairs and so on. And one of the events that you were very, I suppose you were included in, you were fortunate to be part of, was the Reform UK trip to Israel.
Yes.
What were your key takeaways from that trip?
Well, it was back in November, and it was a 7 or 8 day trip. And this is something that the State of Israel do with lots of political parties in lots of different countries, in the West particularly. So Labour have go regularly, the Conservatives have gone fairly regularly. Apparently the Greens aren't interested in going, that's their official position. But I know opinions differ about Israel and the State of Israel, but I found the trip was fascinating. It's my second trip to Israel. I went on a Holy Land tour there with my local church a couple of years earlier. So I went back and it was a different focus completely. This is about how the country is run and about, of course, the 7th of October attacks and the aftermath of that. And 2 days in particular really stuck with me. The first one was we went up to an area called the Golan Heights, which is an upland area in the north of the country that was, until 1967, was part of Syria. And they lost that to Israel during the Six-Day War. My history is not that good. And it's been in Israel's possession ever since, although it's contested. And we went up there, and it is a fairly high, flat upland area above a low plain, which is the rest of Israel. So it's very strategic. And we went there, we could see into Lebanon, we could see into Syria, and all the carnage there, the destroyed buildings, all the Hezbollah rocket attacks. You could see the aftermath of that everywhere, every corner you turned around. It was clearly a few weeks before it had been a war zone. And what stuck with me was that if Israel didn't have the possession of that land, that either the countries or groups within those countries from Syria and Lebanon would use that to attack Israel because they've vowed to destroy them. And you would just have more conflict in the Middle East because the Israelis would never let that happen. So my takeaway from that was they should have possession, sovereign possession of that land now, because it's the best thing overall for that region. It's the most peaceful way of dividing the land. So that was the first day. The second one, and this was quite a hard day actually for all of us, we went to see the kibbutz, a kibbutz in the south of Israel, right next to the Gaza border, which is like a farming commune, if you like. There's no equivalent here. And they basically, 6 o'clock in the morning, they were overrun by terrorists. And we were shown around this facility by a lady who had left the night before with her granddaughter to go and visit a friend. Otherwise, she would have been one of the victims as well. So she took us around all these burnt out buildings and told us about the people who lived there, about their children, about who was taken hostage. And so it was very personal. And we stood in there with a building with bullet holes, blood on the walls, and it'd been blackened furniture that was just bits of metal. So it was very powerful. And then we went to the Nova festival site, which was not far up the road, where they'd had a rave. Lots of young people there, and they'd been the night before. This is the morning after the night before, 6 o'clock in the morning. When they were, I don't think the terrorists were actually expecting to find this festival there. So when they found all these young people there, in a kind of the state they were in, they just had a field day. So there was 350 young people murdered at that site, and we had a girl spoke to us who was one of the survivors, and the reason that she survived was she sustained quite a bad injury to the back of her head early on. And there was a lot of blood loss. It wasn't a serious injury, but there was a lot of blood loss. So she was able to lie face down in the ground, dig herself into the dirt a bit, and then when the terrorists came over and poked the bodies with the guns, they said, oh, she's dead, and they left her. And so that's how she survived and how she was able to tell the story. And the takeaway for me from that day was, apart from the sort of the tragedy of it all, was when you think about what happened and what's ensued since then and the death toll in Gaza, which gets a lot of media time, whether you believe the figures or not, there's certainly thousands have died there, is I think the Israelis were very restrained under the circumstances. If our children... If hundreds of our children were slaughtered like that, I think you would find people would be baying for blood. And I think they've shown restraint, and they've done it in a civilized way, as much as you can do, to defend themselves. So those are my two main takeaways from Israel. And I was very impressed with Israel. And just one of my final points is, the last day we went to the Knesset, and we had a tour around there, like there are Houses of Parliament. And we met the Speaker, and we met someone who worked for him. And this really blew me away. Despite all the attacks since the 7th of October, the 2 years that followed, and the cost of the war, the cost of the isolation, the cost of the sanctions, their economy has grown by 14% each year, right? Now, isn't that amazing? And when he was asked about this, he said, Israelis, get up in the morning and think of ways to make money. And do you know what? I felt so sad because that used to be us, didn't it? Yeah. And you know, you look at the state of the public services in a place like Israel, given that they're in a constant state of war, it's much better than ours. And it just shows you what's possible with the right attitude and the right government. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If you like Dan, you could listen to the latest Reform Party podcast. What do you mean you don't like and subscribe to it already? We're on YouTube and we're also on Apple. I thought I must get that in, otherwise I'll be told off later. But before we finish, Dan, I'd like to ask you a little bit about something you mentioned. You've obviously got a Christian faith.
Yes.
You were part of the launch of Christians in Reform in December. What part does your faith play in your political beliefs?
Well, actually, that is the reason I got involved in politics. I've come to faith later in life. I'm in my 30s, and it's about 15 years, and it's been, because I've come later, it's been quite a serious thing, you know, when I've read the Bible from cover to cover. So I know more than once. So I do understand it. I don't just take it at face value. And so it's been, I felt sort of compelled to get involved in politics because this, I think, is where God was sort of saying, this is where you should be, you know, this is where you need to be. And the more I've got involved, the more I've seen and understood what's really going on in society. I really think this is a critical time for us as a country, and also that, you know, the fact that, you know, there's forces that are trying to undermine our country and undermine civil liberties, freedom, and the fact that we're a nation is significant because, you know, we're a country that's led the world in so many ways, and we've exported so many good things: democracy, the rule of law. We ended slavery. We stood up against the Nazis when we had nothing really to fight them with. We had that moral courage. So I think if you make a place like the UK go dark, then a lot of other places will go dark very quickly as a consequence of that. So I think we are at the front line here of the battle. And I think that's why it's so important what we're doing in Reform, and that we've got a leader in the form of Nigel Farage who is a Christian.
Wonderful. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
David, great to be back with you again. Great to be in such a big, and I hope we'll discover, very sound thinking audience as well. I think we've got about 45 minutes to run through a range of issues. I don't know how we're going to manage that. It's been a fairly boring week in Westminster politics, hasn't it? But we might find one or two things that we can focus on and tickle out from that rather barren landscape. But David, I'm going to want to talk to you about your thesis, become known as the Starkey thesis, about what we need to put right in Britain. And then we'll come on to some of the politics, how we actually mechanically and electorally need to go about that. But I suppose I've got to start by asking you the question that seemed to engage the recent Conservative shadow cabinet away day.
I'm not there yet.
You're not there yet. is Britain broken, was the question. And at the Shadow Cabinet Conservative Away Day, according to Robert Jenrick, there are three possible answers to this question. Yes, Britain is broken. No, Britain isn't broken. Or, yes, Britain is broken, but we don't want to admit it. That seemed to be a view that was held by a good number of Shadow Cabinet ministers around the table. Tell us, is Britain broken?
Yes and no.
There's a fourth answer,
there,
ladies and
there
gentlemen.
There we are. I always used to say that British men, if you remember, enjoyed that wonderful thing called sitting on the fence because they liked the sensation, but there we are. We are not broken as a people, but I think the way we've traditionally run ourselves, which used to be the envy of the world, we invent so many things. We invent representative government. We invent stable administration. We invent that extraordinary, necessary balance between order and freedom. Mm-hmm. We've thrown that away. Or rather, I suppose we were robbed. It's a long process. You can trace it, you know, as always, you can go back to, if arguably, the establishment of the civil service, the 1854, the Northcote Trevelyan reforms, the enormous changes. We must never forget, Britain, in its modern sense, is a product of war. It's the two world wars that fundamentally reshape. And the extraordinary structures that Attlee creates from 45 onwards, they're just a prolongation of the unlimited powers of wartime government. But I think there's a massive, significant change, thanks to Tony Blair, in 1997. Yep. And I think that's the moment at which things radically change. I mean, let's just look at a simple test. You've got one government that comes in that's very different to its predecessor, and it wants to do things. So, for example, as we all know, 1979, Thatcher comes in. Effectively, from 1945 to 1979, you'd had, as we've had now, a uniparty government in which Labour and the Conservatives, although there was public quarrels, effectively, they pursued the same policies. Keynesian nationalisation, prices and incomes policies. Along comes Thatcher, and the state was entirely capable of reversing direction. People kicked and screamed and squalled, and there
were fuss.
But it was done. Similarly, in 1997, when Blair comes in, radical shift. It's done. What's astonishing, this is. If you're a historian or an analysis of politics, as you are, it's always the test of, have I got experimental evidence? Well, we have. Last year, we had somebody who believed passionately in how we're governed. Keir Starmer, elected with a huge, though very shallow, majority. He was totally confident that the only reason we'd been badly governed was Tory sleaze and Tory slackness of mind, mm-hmm. stupidity, what he kept on going on about, the corruptness of Tories, the shallowness, the frequency of change of prime ministers and whatever. He was so confident he barely bothered to think about policy. He appointed not a policy person as his chief of staff, but Sue Gray, who was the kind of, I don't know what she was really, she was sort of enforcer of Downing Street. And you know what? He's not been able to do anything. This is a government which is just locked in a kind of, I mean, literally, the rabbit staring in the yep. headlights. And I think this is the real test. So the question is, what happened?
Yes, that's what I want to get to.
What happened?
When did this? So quite often in the day-to-day sort of political debate where you get, you know, people knocking seven bells out of each other, it typically often comes down to criticisms of personal frailty. You know, this prime minister.
They're very juicy after, you know.
Yeah.
There's wonderful personal frailty on exhibition. Yeah.
But, you know, this person wasn't strong enough or over-compromised or.
Sleaze.
So it was all sort of, you know, Boris's cake and Liz's lettuce and Rishi Sunak's lack of an umbrella when he called a general election. And I'm really pointing out, no doubt, the various characters we've had as our prime ministers do have their foibles and their weaknesses. But what's so important about your analysis and what I want us to tease out in this session is there's something much bigger and systemic going on, right? Mm-hmm. And you've already mentioned Blair. And but it didn't really seem that the time that we noticed it, it was like that boiling frog story that, you know, if you put a frog into a cold pan of water, and supposedly if you heat that up, you can boil the frog alive. If you throw the frog into boiling water, it leaps straight out, so goes the theory. So something started happening in 1997 that we didn't really notice at the time, and we weren't really attuned to precisely what was happening. It was, I don't want to go so far as to say it was a sleight of hand, but it wasn't the focus of our public political debate. As I'm fond of saying, I'm in my my late 40s, well, my very late 40s. Well, I'm 53, so my very late 40s. But I can remember when Blair got in 97, And I didn't vote for the Labour Party, but I was kind of relaxed about it. I kind of thought, well, he's quite moderate. He's signed up to Thatcherite capitalist economics. It's not the outcome we would have ideally wanted, but, you know, I can sleep perfectly well at night. I didn't think there was too much to worry about. Similarly, when Bill Clinton won in the United States of America, right? But this is, I want you to tell us your key analysis of what started going wrong then. And I think even you are humble enough to admit that you didn't quite see it all at the time. So what started happening then? Because at the time, we just thought this guy was a kind of moderate, sensible, competent, charismatic human being. And even if we didn't vote for him, we could be relaxed about it.
I think, again, we need to go back. We really do need to go back. Simon already mentioned my Magna Carta book. Ever since Magna Carta, 1215, all those hundreds and hundreds of years ago, we've basically been governed by one single idea, which is there is a representative body, which we call Parliament, to which we elect people, and we're all bound by the laws and the decisions that are made there because we're all represented there. Mm-hmm. And that's the dominant. Again, the reality shifts from time to time, from what we now have, which is universal franchise, to earlier periods when the whole franchise was wildly odd. But that's the basic idea. Blair, ladies and gentlemen, hated it. Blair hated any notion that government really should answer to you. And this is the central thing we've got to understand. With all Blair's affectations, the glottal stop, the being a man of the people, all of that, there was an intense contempt and distrust for popular opinion. And what he did, and it is designed, it's done with a considerable measure of cunning and some genuine measure of planning, and I think the fundamental intelligence is Gordon Brown. He deliberately removes power from Parliament. So the reason that Starmer can't govern is he, as Prime Minister, is commanding an instrument that's been deliberately blunted, that's actually been put in binding, called it in chains. And he sends power in two very considerably different ways. The first is he sends it to experts, expert committees. The first, the most famous of them, is the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, which sets interest rates. Now, in many ways, government by experts sounds quite a good idea. After all, government does need experts. And there's a very good phrase, and the phrase is fought over by two very great politicians, Teddy Roosevelt in America and Winston Churchill here, on the subject of the ultimate expert, the scientist. And the phrase is, you want your scientists on tap, but not on top. And what, on the contrary, Blair and Brown did was to create a regime of expert bodies where the scientists, the experts, the economists, the statisticians, the experts in English nature are all on top, and they are not answerable to you. There are 400 and odd of these bodies, and they control getting on for a third of state expenditure. You do not appoint them, you do not control what they spend the money on. And if you want a clear illustration, again, as always, the good test case is to look at COVID. During COVID, we were governed by an expert body. They even call themselves sage, like Plato's philosopher kings, because, of course, Greek political philosophy has got two completely different views of how politics should be run. One is Plato. This is Platonic, the idea of the expert up there, deliberately cut off from popular opinion, of which Plato, like Blair, is contemptuous. On the other, my great favourite, Aristotle. Wonderful. The judge of a meal is not the cook, but the eater. That's the key to understanding the role. But if you look during COVID, we were ruled by a committee of experts. They had one mission, to make sure nobody died of COVID. Fine. But in order to do that, what did they do? Shut the entire NHS down, So it didn't matter if you died of a heart attack. Positively welcome, I suppose, really, if you died of cancer. It's killed. It has deliberately damaged cancer care in a fashion which is shocking if you now look at British cancer statistics against European ones. Again, what did we do? Well, we decided we needed lockdown for no very good reason, and the result is you destroy the educational opportunities of three generations of schoolchildren. You incur costs, thanks to furlough and whatever, on the scale of a moderate, in fact, a rather medium-sized war. And the thing above all you do, you deprive people of the need to work. That furlough is catastrophic. That's the result of the rule of the expert. The expert has got... Experts cannot decide things by themselves. Those scientists shouldn't have been in a position to take any of those decisions. Finally, the weighing of, is it worth doing this, should have been the decision of a politician, if somebody answers to you. And so, I mean, so we have this. And remember, as I said, we've got 400 and odd of these bodies. Yeah. We've just seen the whole crisis over water. You've got six separate quangos regulating dozens of different companies. It's an insane way of running policy.
And is the problem here, do you think, that you implied this, or I inferred it? Is the problem that, you know, to a man with a hammer, everything's a nail, right? Every problem's a nail. So that, right, I'm absolutely focused on COVID, therefore all policies will only focus on COVID. That there isn't considering the trade-offs.
This is true in everything. Look again at the whole business of the absurd HS2, the high-speed railway line, which was an insane idea in itself. But because there are a few bats and there is an organisation called English Nature, you decide to spend £100 million on a bat tunnel. Ladies and gentlemen, we could have built three bats Ritz hotels, given each one of these bats their personal butler, you know. Again, it's even worse when you look at Sellafield in order that fish will not be unduly... You're talking about boiling frogs. We're worried about mildly overheating fish. So we construct a fish disco. Ladies and gentlemen, at the cost of six times the bat tunnel, £600 million. Is it any wonder nothing can get done? But you see, the result of all of this is the world that we saw with the whole El Fata business, the admission of this preposterous person whose essential qualification for British citizenship is that he hates Britain. It's now very, the Labour view, this is a necessary qualification for British citizenship. But you see, what you saw there was a whole chaos of different bodies all competing with each other, because alongside these quangos, there are all sorts of charities, which, by the way, you also pay for, that are campaigning for each one of these bodies to do their things. So, you know, alongside English Nature, you've got a whole variety of wildlife charities and whatever, RSPCA and whatever. They have huge amounts of thanks to, I'm afraid, David Cameron and the big society. So the whole thing is a gigantic process, but they all conflict with each other.
Yep.
Because, of course, if you've got somebody who is the built environment lot, loathe English Nature, English Nature loathes anything to do with historic building. They all fight each other.
And isn't the... the devil always has the best tunes, right? And and it often seems to me that the left and those who want a bigger role for the state tend to pick their language very wisely. So all of these groups you'll find described on the mainstream media as independent, the independent expert Office for Budget Responsibility, whose forecasts are an absolute fiasco. I've actually set up myself, and we'll see how it goes, three forecasting models to predict economic growth to compete with the OBR, and we'll see who gets the numbers right over the next year or two. It took me half an hour of my time to set up these three models, about 10 minutes per model. It didn't cost the taxpayer a penny. You're very welcome. I consider this a public service. And I've had one model where I just take their numbers and say I think they tend to be a bit optimistic, halve them, that could end up being the winner. My second model was just to have a random number generator to pump out any random number between 0 and 2. At the moment, that's beating the OBR model, right? And my third was I sort of got to have something that was reflective of the economy, so I built a theory that if good things happen in the high-performing parts of our economy, this has a really good knock-on effect to other parts of the economy. So if you're looking at the really high-performing sectors of our economy doing well, then you would expect the economy to boom. So my third model is based on looking at the total number of goals scored in any Premier League season, taking the square root of it and dividing it by 25. And it looks like that's probably going to beat the OBR economic forecast as well. So, I mean, these people are obsessive, but also, you know, ludicrous, right? They don't even solve the specific problem. I mean, this, you know, if even you care passionately about bats, the idea that that is a valuable expenditure to build a £100 million bat tunnel, this is crazy.
It is literally crazy. But it's the product, again, of an expert not being controlled by anybody who says, this, you know, really is quite a lot of money. And there is nobody doing that. I think there are a whole series of other things. There's a belief in rules. There's a belief in statistics. All of this is quasi-religious. Again, you look at people like Starmer, and they are people who have no what you could loosely call moral sense. Let's actually look at Starmer's behaviour, because he's a real test case of this. When he comes to power, do you remember he'd been denouncing the Tories for sleaze and all the rest of it? And the first thing that he does is, from a rather odd and sleazy gentleman himself, who used rather unkindly to be known in the days when Private Eye was funny as Lord Waheed Boy, Waheed Ali, Waheed Ali starts buying large quantities of expensive clothes, not only for Keir Starmer, but for his wife. And it's not clear how intimate these items of attire are. But everybody sort of says, this is absolutely outrageous. Starmer, I followed the rules. And then it's pinned down, and it's pinned down, and it's pinned down. And the conclusion is arrived at, that he receives gifts. Shall we, again, rather like your statistics, £34,000, two shillings and sixpence. He then solemnly goes and says, I am terribly sorry. There were three occasions when I got it wrong. They were worth £2,621, 14 shillings and 3 farthings. And he literally, solemnly repays that money, thinking it will immediately make him look respectable.
So it's like rules of replaced judgment.
But you see, to any sensible person, that is demented behaviour, obsessive behaviour. But we have a state that functions like that. And you know, it's going to require an enormous exercise of courage and imagination and mockery.
Yeah.
One of the things that's gone completely wrong, we have all of this so-called satire in which the height of wit is to put fuck and Margaret Thatcher in the same sentence. And we've been living with this rubbish for 30 or 40 years. What's needed is genuine, the right has got to recover, yep. Satire. This stuff needs mockery.
Yep.
It needs the flamethrower of wit. So, right, that's one thing that Blair does.
And so we've got all of these quangos, and the Tories continue it.
Oh, the core is multiplied. You were talking about the OBR.
That was a Tory
invention.
That
is the triumphant creation of George Osborne.
Yep. Yep.
So the first thing you do when you come to power is not to say, I've got power. It's to say, oh, I need restricting. I mean, there's a kind of, dare one say it, I believe that there are technical names for this kind of fetish of the need to be locked up. But we have an entire political class that wants to be locked up.
So this is really intriguing. What you therefore see is whether it's the OBR, English Nature, the people that fish discos, the
and climate. I mean, climate change is the one that actually scores most staggering.
Climate change.
The original arrangements are made by Ed Miliband. What does Theresa May do? She actually brings the whole thing forward to 2050, and she legislates it into law. That means all our energy policy, and this will lead us on nicely to the second great shift of Blair, is now determined, believe it or not, not by experts in energy, but by judges.
Yeah.
There is a complete insanity.
So this is what's really interesting. So your story, your thesis, your explanation goes like this. On the one hand, if you like, out of our left arm, Parliament has leaked a load of blood, pints and pints of it, to all of these quangos, right? So it's no longer the kind of education secretary deciding stuff, whatever, it's Ofsted. It's no longer the railway minister deciding about the railway line. It's some idiot who wants to construct a bat tunnel over it, who would obviously wouldn't have won an election on that proposal. So all of that power leaves Parliament and ministerial office and goes to quangos. But on the other hand, there has been an enormous shift in our judiciary, in the way our legal system works, right? I mean, I was going to say I joke, but it's not really a joke. I actually say to people, at the moment in Britain, if you wish to affect immigration policy, don't become an MP, don't even become the Minister for Immigration, become a bloody judge, because they're having more influence on the interpretation of what allows you to stay or not be deported than the members of Parliament do. So tell us about how parliamentary democracy, the discretion of politicians, has also, on the right-hand side of our body politic, if you like, bled out and empowered judges and lawyers.
I think, again, we've got to understand there are several big ideas here. And you made mention before of the skill of the left. The left, ladies and gentlemen, has captured language. And once you've captured language, you are lost. And language has been captured in several ways as far as law is concerned. The first is we no longer have, and law is no longer taught in our universities or in our ends of court, as a neutral instrument, weighing the case claims of one person against another. It's an instrument of social justice. It's got an end, a purpose, which is equality and socialism. The second thing is there's been a fundamental transformation in the way our law works, because we've imported deliberately a completely foreign set of concepts into law. Traditionally, common law is highly specific, highly localized, sharply and precisely worded. The first great change that Blair did was to bring in, incorporate the European Convention on Human Rights. And ladies and gentlemen, the European Convention on Human Rights is the absolute polar opposite of how law has traditionally been written in England. It says things like, you have a claim to family life. Literally nothing more than that. Now, any judge takes one look at that and goes, yippee! I can make of that absolutely what I want. And that's precisely what happens. But there's an even more fundamental point. Think about it. I said it's this capturing of language. Think about human rights. Don't you all feel warm? Doesn't a kind of, you know, sort of little wriggle of self-satisfaction, isn't there a sort of little touch of Paddington Bear? Don't you see universal human rights, you know, there with that little red pork pie hat, a sweet little manila luggage label saying Pawoo, a battered leathered suitcase? Do you get the idea? But ladies and gentlemen, think about it. If you believe in European, or still worse, universal human rights, that means, and this is going back to, I said, we were a nation state. The nation was ruled by itself through Parliament. But if you believe in universal human rights, there's a body above Parliament, beyond Parliament, Europe, or the world. In fact, it's even worse than that. If you think about it rationally, if you believe in universal human rights, you believe in a universal human being. You believe there's no such thing as history, there's no such thing as tradition. You mean, you believe, and we can see, if you look at the policies of the Green Movement explicitly, and the Labour Party in practice, you believe there is no difference between the newly landed immigrant, once he's washed up a bit, you know, and the fingernails trimmed, and you sort that funny beard out, and maybe put him into new stolen jeans, you know, he's just like one of us, isn't he? Well, you know that's a lie. But that is now the presumption of the law.
So, and this was because we put the European Convention, this is, embedded it in the Human
because,
Rights Act.
Because we embedded it in a legal system that operated on a completely different basis. So you give judges who are used to highly specific... You were talking about why judges have changed their behaviour. Because they've been given a new toy.
Huge discretion.
They've given a huge new toy. But it's even worse than that. The man who was largely responsible for this behind Jack Straw was a very distinguished lawyer called Tom Bingham. And he spells it out wisely in a lecture in Australia rather than here. And he says the following, listen carefully. Human rights, by their nature, are anti-democratic, counter-majoritarian, and protect the minority at the expense of majorities. And he goes on and he lists the minorities, beginning with the mentally sick. Ladies and gentlemen, Kalokani and Ruda Kabana are not an accident. This is written into our law. Mm-hmm. When people like Robert Jenrick have gone on about two, indeed Nigel Farage, have gone on about two-tier justice, this is not an accident. This is not the result. I mean, you were making the distinction between a system and individuals. This is not the result of a particular silly judge. This is now deliberately part of the system. And it has to be rooted out. And there's been an even bigger change, which is with the creation of the Supreme Court. You now have judges effectively saying Parliament isn't the boss. The tradition was always the idea, it's called the sovereignty of Parliament. Now, the sovereignty of Parliament doesn't just mean people sort of wandering around in full-bottom wigs and whatever. Parliament is sovereign because you are. It represents the majority. That is its fundamental definition. The judges have decided they don't like that. So they've invented a new thing called the rule of law. And they've decided that is a co-equal principle to that of the sovereignty of Parliament, which is why you had, whatever we may think about Boris Johnson, the extraordinary business of the Supreme Court, led by Brenda Hale, ruling the prorogation of Parliament illegal. Ladies and gentlemen, the prorogation of Parliament has been used in parliamentary management since at least the reign of Elizabeth I. The only reason that Elizabeth actually got her reformation through Parliament was that you quickly declared a long a prorogation over Easter, which meant that everybody who was opposed to Elizabeth's measures could be banged up in jail because parliamentary privilege didn't apply during the holidays, as it were. But going... The Labour Party does exactly that when it's changing the Parliament Acts and whatever. But so what we've done, we have judges now who actually think they are the boss. Now, what is the background to this? Why did it happen? Well, I think you're all members of a party. You know you wear a badge of shame. You're called populists. This disgusting thing that no decent person can touch. I always try to point out to people, I was once too, I was tarred with this terrible term. I was told I was a popular historian. I said, well, you know, I think it's probably better than being an unpopular historian. However, why do we need this term populist? We need it because of that weird definition that we got from Tom Bingham. If you believe that the purpose of law is to protect minorities, you cannot have democracy, because democracy means the rule of the majority, which is what, of course, it used to mean. So we've decided now we've got to have a thing called liberal democracy. The country that invents it, you will remember, is Germany, because of the experience of Nazism and whatever. And have you noticed what the latest manifestation of liberal democracy in Germany is? The serious consideration being given to banning the equivalent of, I suppose, Reform, the AfD in Germany, because it's the most popular political party. That's the logic.
So actually, the populists are the Democrats. Really.
The populists
are,
that is, you've got to embrace that word. We have got to re-embrace that word. And that has to be, again, all sorts of things have got to be re-embraced. The fundamental thing that we have to re-embrace is the idea that the one central purpose of politics, which is the nation. In our case, it is Britain. It's why the whole MAGA movement is so impressive. It's got the clear focus. It's America, first, centre, last. Yep. We need the same thing. We've got a politics which is deliberately contemptuous of the national interest.
And that, on the judge's power, I mean, there'll be endless examples of it, but the one that sticks in my mind, I probably should have looked up the exact reference, but I'm sure many of you in the audience will recall it as well. Some months ago, there was an exchange over the dispatch box at Prime Minister's Questions between Kemi Badenoch and Keir Starmer. And the point of contention was around a Palestinian family who had been allowed into the UK under rules which had been explicitly written for Ukrainian refugees, right? There was a separate set of rules specifically for Ukrainians that wasn't supposed to apply to anybody else, but the courts had allowed this family in even though they were not Ukrainian under that set of rules. And there's a bit of back and forth between Starmer and Badenoch over the dispatch box. Not much back and forth, actually. I think Starmer and Badenoch more or less agreed, unusually, on it. What happens next? The Lady Chief Justice comes out, and she doesn't say, oh, perhaps I could provide some useful clarification for why we did apply these Ukrainian rules to the Palestinians, and, you know, it's up to the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, or anybody else to work out if they wish to change the law, but perhaps I could just, for the benefit of the public, explain what our rationale was. No. She doesn't do that. She comes out and says, how very dare these politicians discuss this matter in Parliament? Who on earth do you think you are?
And even
so
more,
in her mind, the immigration is not a topic for legitimate debate over the dispatch box in Parliament. It's absolutely extraordinary.
The even more extraordinary case, of course, is the Sentencing Council.
Yes.
And the guidelines of the Sentencing Council. Parliament, in theory, sets what the penalty for an offence should be. The judges have decided this is not good enough. They have a special body in which they decide what sentence they will actually impose. It's usually a fraction of the one that Parliament has imposed. This body decided that in every case where imprisonment is proposed for a minority or for a woman, in other words, for anybody but a white male, there should be a referral to probation services, which is, of course, the first step to a much reduced sentence. Jenrick raised this case, his opposite number, for once, actually agreed, Mahmoud actually agreed that this was outrageous. The Lady Chief Justice says, this is the separation of powers. This is a deranged idea. So, and the aggression and the defensiveness. But it has happened because politicians deliberately decided it should happen.
That they would give this away.
They would give this away. And anybody, as it were, who wants to take it back is denounced as illiberal, as a populist, as, you know, again, why is this term fascist so constantly on people's lips and applied to the most inappropriate people? I've been called a fascist. Nigel is called a fascist the whole of the time. It's ludicrous. It is because everything goes back to the decision in 1945 to embrace universal values, to embrace the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And what happens, of course, and this is right from the beginning, there was a devil. There was the snake in paradise, which was the fact that our principal ally was the Soviet Union, who was, of course, determined to undo mm-hmm. all of these things. And above all, what they use the charge of fascist to deny freedom of speech to anybody on the right. This has been the trick that has been played ever since 1945. We've got to get wise to these things.
Yep.
There's got to be, again, and this is the disaster, particularly of the right, and particularly the disaster of the Cameron and the May years. The right got frightened of being called racist or fascist or whatever. So we simply started to go along with it. And in order to make ourselves look good, we went further.
Yep.
And you have the ludicrous position that the right wing in this country tried for many years, two decades in fact, to, as it were, receive the praise of Guardian readers, who under no circumstances would ever vote for the right anyway.
So, David, look, I'm conscious we're on the clock. So this is the precis of your analysis is absolutely fascinating. And I think as we've gone around the country and talked to audiences, but also as we've been talking to senior politicians as well, it's gaining traction. That what has happened, slowly but surely, is Parliament has withered because huge amounts of power have been going out in one direction to these god-awful independent expert committee quangos, meaning that the politicians, love them or loathe them, we tend to loathe them, but love them or loathe them, don't have the power anymore. And on the other hand, to the lawyers, to the judges, right? So what is to be done? I mean, Reform UK, this is an incredible phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, as we've gone around the country, the size and scale and enthusiasm for this relatively new political party that seems to have tapped into a sense out there that things aren't going too well. There's a sort of, maybe not resentment yet, but concern, disquiet, that things are getting away from us. It's not the country we used to be. What does this party or the next government need to do about this so we don't just go through shuffling out politicians with one colour rosette and another lot come in and they disappoint? How do we fix the system? How do we persuade the Reform Party, if it is to be them who form the next government, to change the system? What has to happen to win this battle?
We've got to identify the problem, as I've tried to do. We've got to recognise that any incoming Reform government or coalition of the right has got to understand this double evacuation of power from Parliament, and they have to be prepared and forearmed to undo it. The first thing you've got to do is to carry out a great repeal of the entire constitutional legislation of the Blair government from start to finish. I would argue you need to do it. Now, I know the word constitution sounds highfalutin and all the rest of it. Can I explain? Everything that's gone wrong finally goes back to this. The economic stasis, our inability to do anything, our inability to build, to drive a railway, all of these things go back to this. We're like Gulliver, if you remember, Gulliver in Lilliput, where these little people tie him down with all of these bonds. And I'm sorry, I'm using an awful lot of bondage analogy. it's not my thing, I assure you, but honest Gov. I have many vices, but that's not one of them. Those bonds must be torn off before we can do anything, before we can begin the necessary program of reconstruction. You see, Thatcher was in exactly the same position. There'd been a similar rule by a uniparty, as I said, from 45 up to 1979. And then it was called Butskillism. You had Hugh Gaitskell on the side of the Labour Party. He, of course, was much smarter than the poor Conservative. He'd been to Winchester, and R.A. Butler had only been like the Princess of Wales to Marlborough, but never mind. But there was a common agreement on all the basic forms of policy until Keith Joseph and until Margaret Thatcher. And then what does Thatcher do? She undoes. She pulls things down. She repeals trade union legislation. She sells council houses. She breaks the old patterns. And you've got to have the courage to do that. You've got to break first. Now, this is not revolution. This is restoration. This is putting things back. We've been so used to these points, and you, Mark, have been very interesting on this. Even in that MAGA, Make America Great Again, there's a sense of loss. There's a sense of things being taken away. Take back control. But of course, the problem was Brexit was a misfire. We thought the problems were in Europe. They weren't. Well, they are, but they're here. They're here. And you know, we were much too worried about Brussels. The real problem is here. It's in Westminster. It's in Whitehall. It's in that multitude. It's in the Supreme Court. There is where we've got to target. But reform is going to face, ladies and gentlemen, opposition that will make the miners fighting Margaret Thatcher look like child's play. The entire structure of the Lords, of the civil service, of the judiciary, of this multitude of quangos, of the great bulk of the media class, of the universities, will all be turned against us. So you have to be prepared. There has to be the difference of Trump Mark I and Trump Mark II. That astonishing moment at the inauguration. Remember, the entire ceremony cut down simply to a moment of swearing in the Bible, going straight into the Oval Office, and Trump sits down at the Resolute desk. Behind him, there's that faintly sinister figure of Stephen Miller, the Deputy Chief of Staff, and that huge pile of executive orders, and they're signed, and things happen. We've got, once again, to have politicians who are capable of doing something, yep, not just gesture, action.
And David, we are... We're right on the clock here, but I said at the outset it had been a boring week in Westminster. what's your friendly advice to this crowd, to this party, that has, you know, doubled its share of the vote since the general election, has recruited in the form of Danny Kruger and Robert Jenrick, two of the brightest political thinkers on the centre-right in Britain? What can these guys do? Not just in terms of the kind of campaigning that they'll all be encouraged to do by their party and knocking on doors and putting up posters and the rest of it. Intellectually, what can they do to spread this argument, to share this analysis, to make sure that when we finally get rid of this wretched government, that for all of the battle royales to come, we are as equipped as we can be from 2027, 28, 29, whenever the election is, to tilt the odds as decisively as possible in the favour of an incoming reforming government. How can they help?
I think there are two things. The first is you within the Reform Party need constantly to be reminding your MPs, the party leaders, the chairman, this is the central task. There are two jobs. One is to make sure you're elected, but above all, to make sure that you're not just in government, you are in power. And that means the controlling the instruments of power and knowing what you want to do with them. And the second is to, as it were, what Mark and I call the exercise we've been doing just now, we call it evangelizing, just like Jesus and the disciples, going round persuading people. You should be doing that work of persuading in your everyday lives with family and friends at the people in the pub. Now, you may get the odd dust-up. It would be astonishing if you didn't. But, ladies and gentlemen, it's worth it. It's worth it. Because we are, again, let's call things by their proper names. We are confronting a national disaster which I think is as grievous a threat to Britain as either of the world wars. If we do not grasp this moment, if the next right-wing government fails or fails to get elected, we will have been defeated. And when I use that word defeat, I'm not using a turn of phrase. The first thing that will happen is reparations. That's what the word means, reparations. We will be forced to pay the vast trillions that Lenny Henry and David Lammy talk about. We will be treated as a defeated people. If you want to walk under the yoke, go ahead. I don't.
Please put your hands together for David and Mark. What a fantastic talk.